brought up. Now, it seemed like you guys were talking in reference to the 40-meter band. Comparing the verticals, it sounded like a four square over a dipole. And like you mentioned, there's so many variables in terms of propagation because it can shift and alternate quite a bit. I've experienced in the past that, yes, I've had both vertical and Yagi in the air and have, you know, switched to find that many times, as much as a six element or a four element, believe it or not, just didn't make the contact and switched over to a quarter wave, half wave vertical setup, and boom, that was 5 and 9. So I was able to make the contact. So yeah, it's good if you can have both, to have both. It's quite interesting experience, and it's lots of fun. To be quite surprised what a vertical can do. Now, in terms of four squares, you know, the one that what gets me is that when you're talking about a four square and you're switching a phased array of four element verticals, do you not have more dBV gain over a single element dipole? And aren't the lobes much wider in that particular direction? For example, your four square is actually acting as a vertical beam in a particular direction. So do you not get better, don't you get more dBD gain over over a single element dipole, even if that dipole is up 40 feet in the air?
A little bit difficult to make that comparison, Eric, because on any one day, you're going to see a huge difference between horizontal polarization and vertical polarization, depending on the state of the ionosphere and what polarization your buddy launched when he transmitted to you. So that makes the comparison difficult. However, if I built both of these antennas on a theoretical great big flat plane of metal out in space, so I have no ionosphere to work with, and I'm really measuring the gain difference between the two, without a doubt, a four-element four-square, properly fed, will outperform a dipole by quite a few dB. That's the good news. Another piece of good news about the four-square, although those elements are only vertical, you wish they also had horizontal capability, but because they're only vertical, if you're phasing harness, if you're phasing electronics, let's call it, you got a box with a switch on it where you can select how much power you feed to each of the four elements of your four square and what phase angle. Once you've got that capability, and it's not very difficult to establish it, you now have electronic steering. You can now steer that beam, to be a little bit ridiculous, every 5 degrees at a time. I'll admit that the beam width is going to be maybe 60 degrees wide, and steering every 5 degrees doesn't seem like much. However, depending on how you feed those four elements, you can steer nulls in very particular directions. So if you've got a real loud QR Mary coming off to one side, 90 degrees away, or 75 degrees away, there's a real strong thunderstorm in that direction. If you've got enough adaptability to the way you feed those four squares, you can steer a null in the antenna pattern in that direction and drop down that QR Mary or that thunderstorm by maybe 15 or so dB, maybe even 20 dB. And that can definitely make the difference between an extremely pleasant QSO and one where you can't copy the guy. So the electronic steering of a four square, if you built enough capability into the system, has a lot going for it. With a Yagi on 40 meters, very rarely is a guy going to have full capability of mechanically steering the Yagi. Although, once he decides to build them out of wires and catenaries and ropes, he could build a couple of Yagis and aim them in a couple of different directions and just feed the right one, or again feed combinations of those. This whole phased array electronic steering is a subject in ham radio where almost none of us have scratched the surface. The closest I came to it is with my electronic zoom control on my that I had on my array of 16 Yagis. That's the closest I've come. I haven't really done electronic steering yet, but I'd like to. And I think we should all consider it because, in general, it's not expensive. Back to you, Eric.
Okay, very good there, Dick. Well, I'm glad you mentioned that because, you know, there's a lot of misconceptions in two shows that I normally listen on, and, you know, the guys, you know, mention things about verticals, how verticals may be inefficient compared to dipoles or Yagis, and sometimes in a way they are, sometimes in a way they aren't. And I always said it's all, as you said, how you install that vertical. If it's installed, constructed properly, you have a very efficient and a well-performing vertical setup. Even one vertical with the right amount of radials cut properly, not loaded type coil verticals, but air coil verticals or capacitor coils, or I'm not sure of the proper term, but one vertical that does not have traps is the way to go. I think the butternut, I think the HV6, or the two-bander butternuts is actually one example of seems to be a well-efficient vertical that I've seen a lot of guys use because it doesn't use the lossy traps. But not to compare the manufacturer-type verticals. Just electrically in general, as a contester, for the 80-meter and 160-meter band, and sometimes the 40-meter band, a lot of heavy contesters rely on a four-square. Of course, they have the room, they have the time, sometimes the money, to install a four-square setup and install it where they can adjust the phase angle of a four-square with the help of a beverage antenna for receiving purposes. That reduced the amount of QR Mexico, but they rely solely on the four-square vertical setup for transmitting. It seems to be unbeatable in comparison to a dipole. Now, a dipole vertically oriented, you know, inverted V, where it's omnidirectional, at 100, let's say 150 feet, if you have a 150-foot tower, almost quite seems to be unbeatable as well. But how many guys actually have 150-foot towers to put that apex at that height? So they rely on four squares. And there's many ways you can construct the four square to be broadbanded and a lot better than the simple, you know, half-inch, three-quarter type radiator. Some are making them out of towers. Four square, you know, roll 25, you know, 20 feet or 30 foot each tower, sections of tower, and loading those towers with a four square. But when it comes to verticals, it seems that as a contester on the 40 through 160 meter bands, they are unbeatable. Over a dipole. They are directional as a dipole, but as you said, you can construct it to have to actually adjust the phase angle of it and get a much better directional pattern and front-to-back rejection, reducing QR Mexico. So if you take the time and install it correctly, instead of putting a dipole, it's probably well worth the time and the money. As you said, sometimes it could also be inexpensive to build. Depends on what you're using for the vertical radiator. But anyway, what else? Anyway, back to you there, Dick. K2RW and TechNet and 2RA Mobile.
And when you're comparing a full-length vertical quarter-wave ground plane antenna to one that has loading coils and it's foreshortened, if I was doing that comparison in space with a great big sheet of metal acting as my ground plane, and I'm using shortened verticals versus full-length verticals, I would find out that the gain between the two is almost the same with only a half a dB of difference for the highly foreshortened vertical with all kinds of loading coils. However, down on Earth, the difference is going to be greater for a couple of reasons. Number one, we've all got some local obstructions. Particularly in Richmond Hills, you've got all kinds of nearby buildings, water towers, and things like that, trees. And so altitude counts some. And the full length vertical, the tip of it is higher above the ground than the one that's foreshortened with the loading coils. The loading coils don't have to be lossy. If you have any belief that the loading coils are lossy, you can find out real fast. Put 100 watts into it for 3 minutes, 5 minutes, turn up the power and run over there and touch everything. If it dissipates more than 1 watt, the heat that your hand will sense will tell you right away that it was dissipating power. If those coils are running essentially cold, they're not wasting power. Of all the power you pour into an antenna, there's only three things the antenna can do with it. If the antenna's got some VISWR, it reflects some of it back to the transmitter. If the antenna has got some resistive loss somewhere, something's going to get hot. If it doesn't have resistive loss and doesn't have VISWR, there's nothing left but radiating that signal into space. You may not be thoroughly happy as to where it went in space, but it's going to radiate it. So, as long as your antenna has low VISWR and runs cold, it is 98% efficient as far as what power you put into it versus what gets radiated. So now, the foreshortened antenna, vertical ground plane type, has a lower altitude for the tip, doesn't climb over the obstructions nearby, and you could get some, I'm going to pick a number, you might get 8 dB less performance out of one that's highly foreshortened versus one that's full length. But for the antenna itself, tested in free space on a huge ground plane of copper, you only find less than 0.5 dB of difference. That's the so-called infinite dipole section of Krauss's book. That's what he's saying. And I believe it. As an occupation daily, I occasionally am forced to make very small antennas with all kinds of loading coils in them. And if I'm doing a good enough job with the right materials, I can make 95% of all the RF I put into them get radiated into space with the antenna pattern of a foreshortened dipole almost identical to a full-length half-wave dipole. The bandwidth gets narrow, the Q gets high, you can't QSY as easily with the one that's been made very, very short. You give that up, but at the frequency you've tuned it, it'll give you the performance. Now, Foursquare, I'm not convinced that very many people have used all the capability for the electronic steering and electronic knowing. Not many guys know about that yet. I think they will. So, as you may have heard me say earlier, the fourth edition of the Antenna Engineering Handbook just came out last Friday. Got distributed to people who ordered it early for the first time. It's got 1,800 pages of antenna hardcore engineering information. 59 chapters, 15 brand new chapters, 80 authors for those 59 chapters. You haven't heard the end of the story yet when it comes to antennas. I used to brag about the fact that there's 5,000 kinds of antennas. There may be more. It's part of the story. Mel, I probably have another email. Why don't you go for another one? K2KEY. K2RIW in the tech net.
Hey, first button. Stand by if anyone wants to make any further comments about any of the above before we go on to the next one.
CAV.
I believe somebody said, was it CAV or TAV? Go ahead.
Affirmative. KE6. CAV, Charlie Alpha Victor. Just want to know if you guys were taking questions from the floor. If you are, I've got one. If not, I'll continue on with the current emails.
Why don't you give us your name and give us your question.
Thank you, gentlemen. My name is Bernie here. As you can tell from the call sign, I'm not exactly from here. I've been on the TechNet a couple of times with silly questions, but I've got another one for you. anyway, I moved here. I've been out of Hamming for a few years, but I just started back again. And have a question about how to test RF attenuators. I've got a number of them sitting in my shop here that I need to determine if they're any good. I bought them at a swap meet. And I'm thinking through the process of how to test them on the bench other than running RF through them. Is there a formula of the resistance that I should see? But the more I think about this, I believe there's going to be a resonance issue and a bunch of other things that I'm not necessarily going to be able to measure with a standard voltometer. So anyway, just would like to get your opinion on that in any direction you can give me. Standing by with KE6 CAV.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you're talking about a step attenuator, either the kind that's got switches or a rotary step attenuator. Some of them go in 1 dB steps, some of them go in 10 dB steps, some of them with the switches, you have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 10, 20, and so on dB steps. Most of the time, those step attenuators are made as either pi sections or T sections. In other words, if you go to the appropriate chapter of the Reference Data for Radio Engineers, darn good book, and I think it's in its 8th or 9th edition, and they've changed the name a little bit on the later edition. I think it's called Reference Data for Radio Engineers and Computer Scientists or something like that. They've added a little bit to the title. But there's a section in there on attenuators. And the section on attenuators is broken up into pi section types and T section type attenuators. And your attenuators are one or the other. I think pi is a little bit more popular than T. And when you go to the appropriate chapter, it'll give you a spreadsheet telling you exactly how many ohms are the shunt resistors and how many ohms are the series resistors in a pi attenuator, when it's made for 1 dB, 2 dB, all of the denominations. The values are there. And if you want something in between, if you decide you wanted a 3.5 dB attenuator, they give you the formula by which you can calculate it. Once you know that it's a pi section type attenuator, once you know what the resistors are, by looking at that diagram, by drawing yourself a diagram on paper, Bernie, you'll be able to figure out exactly what your ohm meter is going to see when you go from center conductor on one end to center conductor on the other end, or center conductor to ground on either end. You'll know. And so that way you can check it. That way, every well-made step attenuator will pass the ohm meter test. Depending on how the resistors are laid out, your attenuator may only be rated to 100 megacycles. And beyond 100 megacycles, the individual resistors are so big, and they've got lead lengths that are so long, and the switches are so big, that it starts becoming inductive, or capacitive, or both, and it starts behaving a little bit crazy. But a good attenuator, used within its specified frequency range, will give you the right amount of attenuation at your RF frequency, will give you the exact right amount of resistance with your ohm meter. With rare exception, you can test a good attenuator with the ohm meter. Back to you, Bernie.
Interesting. Thank you very much. I just wanted to verify that book. Is that by a Valkenburg and Middleton?
I don't recognize that name. Might be, but I don't recognize it. And by the way, if you Google resistive step attenuator plus pi section or plus T section, guarantee there is 50 references out there which will give you that spreadsheet of how many ohms is each one of the resistors for each number of dBs. So even if you don't have the book, I guarantee you're going to find it on a website. Back to you, Bernie.
Excellent. Unfortunately, can't type while I'm talking, but I will definitely do that. I also found, I believe, the book on Amazon. I am a full-time programmer and full-time college student, so as you might imagine, I'm rather busy. That does give me access to a fairly extensive library, so I will do a Google search tonight and actually hit the library tomorrow and see if I can get my hands on one quick. And the one on Amazon looks like a very interesting book. I think I will order one. They're a bit steep in price, but as you know from the technical industry, if it isn't steep in price, it's probably not good technical information.
Okay, the one that you found, tell me the title it has, Bernie.
It's titled Reference Data for Engineers. I'm sorry, let me start over. Reference Data for Engineers Radio, comma, Electronics, comma, Computer and Communications, parentheses, Reference Data for Engineers, by a Mac E. Van Valkenburg and a Wendy M. Middleton. It's a hardcover, looks like a published date of October 2001. Retails 160, they're going used for about 126.
And who is the publisher?
I'm sorry, that's not jumping out at me right now. It is the 9th edition.
Okay, that's it. That's the book. I've got, I think, the 8th edition, and there's one in 2001. I'm one rev down. I've got every single edition from the 5th up to the 8th. It looks like I'm one rev down. Darn good book. Lots of good information in there. The equation of the world is in there, as I say it. But you don't have to buy that book. You don't have to find that book. There's a website out there that's going to tell you all the resistor values for a pi-type attenuator. And therefore, you can confirm with your ohmmeter. Do bear in mind that the ohmmeter test, 98% of the time, is going to tell you you got a good attenuator. There's a slim chance that the switches make slightly flaky contacts and it behaves a little bit different with RF than it does with an ohmmeter. That's kind of rare. And once in a blue moon, I've seen one that creates PIM, D-I-M, passive intermodulation distortion because of ratty contacts of the switches. Again, kind of rare. Not to worry about it. Also, bear in mind that step attenuators usually are very power limited, the switchable step attenuators. Very few of them can tolerate more than 1 watt. I know because I've had this beautiful precision step attenuator made by Hewlett-Packard rated from DC to 18 gigahertz. I made the mistake one day of putting it in series with my receiver because I wanted to measure some signal strengths that were coming in on 2 meters. I forgot that it was there. I left it at the 3 dB step, and I started transmitting one day. And boy, did I burn it up fast. I put 30 watts through something that's rated for 1 watt. And the process of getting it repaired was a lot more difficult than I expected. So be careful about putting power through those. Going to turn it back to Mel, and Mel, you're going to give us the next email. K2KEY, K2RIW.
Roger, it's K2KEY. Yeah, I've always been able to take them apart, Dick, and put them back into good working order. Picked up a number of them very cheap. And usually the switches have got to be cleaned up real well. They get, tarnished and, just general grime and everything in there. And the resistors, for the most part, are very good quality stuff. So like you say, really, unless you really fry the thing, you'll find that the resistors are very, very well, good quality, well made. Basically, to the point where you gotta really look to really damage one of these things before you really, go out of your way really to damage it. So, like you say, unless you make a mistake like you did there. other than that, you can even repair them. No problem with them whatsoever. Let's see, what else was I gonna comment on here? Oh yeah, the book, my video engineering handbook. Oh my God, that thing is looking like ratty. That's the only thing. I got scotch tape holding wrapped around the edge of the book. That really, that's been open and closed a gazillion times. I don't know. You want to take one more?
Go for it, Mel.
Here's one that you really will get a kick out of. Are you familiar with WA9HUV parabolic reflectance over?
I think that's the stressed parabolic reflector, a little bit similar to the one that I published in August 1972, QSD. Go ahead.
Hey, this person writes to me and he says, I have a chance to get a number of them that are up on a tower. They do look like they've taken a bit of a beating. Let's see, what are there? Three of them. And let's see. Says three of them have to be taken down. And what do you think of these? Are they is it worth the effort of taking down these three parabolics? I understand that this W9A9HUV designed these antennas, and they were marketed by a company called Mark Antennas, and the chief engineer by the name of Edward Harris says that these were the best designed open grid parabolic antennas ever designed and put on the market. Does that sound familiar to you? Well, this again is really up your alley, Dick. Over.
Yeah, I recognize him. Norm Foote had a whole series of articles in Ham Radio Magazine way back in the 60s. And a good Illinois VHF, UHF ham radio operator. Hope he's not a silent key. Now, let's see now. Just Googled him. I mean, I've QRZ'd him. And he last updated his license in 1986. It expires in August of 2006. Not a good sign. Sounds like Norm is no longer with us. Born in 1915. Okay. My guess is Norm is no longer with us. Probably a silent key. Darn good question. Getting them down from the tower could be a bit of a chore. And are they worth it when they've been out in the weather? If you're a serious guy operating on 1296 or above, a parabolic dish is certainly worth considering. With rare exception, do not use a parabolic dish below 1296. Unless somebody gives you a 28-foot D.S. Kennedy dish, the ones that were made for offshore oil drilling rigs for a tropospheric communication network. Somebody gives you one of those, yeah, I'd use it on 2 meters, 432, and 1296. But in general, 1296 or below dishes really shine above 1296. If you're a 432 operator, don't go there. One good Yagi can easily give you the gain of an 8-foot diameter parabolic dish, 7-foot diameter, something in that order. So you get a lot less wind load, a lot less weight of aluminum, and a lot less dollars out of a well-tuned Yagi. So if the guy is a 2200 megacycle, here we go, 2.3 gig ham radio operator and above, particularly 10 gigs, yeah, you want to use a dish. But now on 10 gigs, you want the dish to have an accuracy to the nearest eighth of an inch from parabolic deviations. And if he's standing on the ground and sees these antennas that are kind of dimpled and beat up in the weather, I'm not so sure that it's worth the effort, Mel. Go ahead.
Okay. It goes beep, so it's a beep. He's got three of them on the tower, he says here. I have to read this whole thing. There's quite a lot of information he's conveying here. He says 432, 1296, 2304, three of them up there. And he says, the material looks pretty good. He says, I think, he says, the screening may be needing a repair. However, the quality of the material was supposed to be first rate. And the write-up, he says, on these antennas was that they are extremely well designed and well constructed. And do you think there's anything on the market now that is of equal quality or better quality than what he produced with Mark antennas? I guess Mark antennas must have I don't vaguely remember something about Mark antennas. I don't know why. I don't know. I guess they're not in business anymore. Did they really produce, he says, mil-spec type of antennas take over?
Don't recognize the name Mark antennas. But when it comes to 432, 1296, and 2304 antenna, one for each band, I'm having trouble believing that the 432 is even worth considering. I would no longer use a parabolic dish on 432 unless it is more than 12 feet, probably 18 feet in diameter. I wouldn't even consider it. And I don't think Norm had the wherewithal to put an 18-foot dish on a tower and let the wind out of Elmhurst, Illinois, not blow it down on it, if you know what I mean. Now, the dish itself, is it used on higher bands? Quite possibly so. And if the rib structure that makes up the parabolic curve is strong enough and in good shape, repairing the material of the dish, the screening, is fairly easy. All kinds of ways you can patch it. naive person would think that the patch would have to be thoroughly, perfectly welded in compared to all the other screening in order to behave correctly. Nowhere near that severe a requirement. As long as the patch has a reasonable amount of overlap, of let's say a quarter wave of overlap between the patch and the rest of the material is there, it'll give you 90-some-odd% of the performance you're going to get as if it was perfectly welded in. And if you want to be a purist, maybe Norm used quarter-inch hardware cloth, and you're going to patch with quarter-inch hardware cloth, you want to be a purist, you can solder down those corners, because galvanizing hardware cloth, if the galvanizing is still there, it is solderable. I've done it. But lots of guys worry about the fact that the screening is made out of horizontal rods and vertical rods, and are you getting perfect contact where the horizontals and the verticals meet? Not required. The horizontal rods reflect the horizontal polarization, the vertical rods reflect the vertical polarization, and if there was absolutely no contact at the joints between the two, you would still get all of the performance the antenna is going to give, all the reflector is going to give you. So the real quality of an antenna, a parabolic antenna, is the accuracy and strength of the ribs that are giving you the parabolic shape. The screening is very repairable. Back to you, Mel. KQRIW, we got to wait for the beep.
Oh, it may not be 432, but he said a 3.7 meter dish. Now, could it be 3.7 meter dish? Could he have been using that on 2304, Dick, over?
Absolutely. But a 3.7 meter dish, let me think now. That's 16 feet in diameter. Yeah, it'll work on 432, but it ain't worth it. You can get a lot more gain with a lot less weight and wind load out of Yagis. And a 14, 15 foot diameter dish, could you use it on 2304? Yes, you could. And let me think now. 2304, the beam width, the bandwidth is 4.5 inches. Let me round that off very roughly to half a foot. 14 feet, 28, let's make it 35, 2-degree beam width. So on 2304, a 3.7 meter diameter dish is going to have very close to a 2-degree beam width. Usable, but boy, you better have a pretty steady tower and a darn accurate rotator. Back to you, Mel.
Roger. Yeah, okay, very good. What else? Let me see what else he says about it. He says, also he says there's one is a 2.1 meter dish on there, and that may have been, maybe the 2.1, he may have actually, 2.1 was around 7 foot or so. Maybe that was, he was using that for a TVRO system. Could that possibly be over?
Very unlikely. 2.1 meters is 6.5 feet. Can you build a TVRO at a 6.5 feet? Not a very good one. Only a couple of the very strong satellites are going to give you a TVRO. The minimum in this area is 8 feet, 10 feet. Yeah, there was a guy who used a 6 foot dish right at the center of the footprint in Oklahoma. I do remember him in the early TVRO articles. He built a super good low noise preamplifier, and with a 6 foot dish, he did manage to get some of the strong satellites, geosynchronous satellites, geostationary. But minimum diameter TVRO really is 8 to 10 feet. So, and by the way, I'm wondering, since most of your email would be coming from people listening to the TechNet, and that's the tri-state area, and since these antennas are in Elmhurst, Illinois, is this guy thinking of going to Illinois to pick up the antennas? Does he have a real good set of photography of the antennas to know what he's going to encounter when he gets there? And is he a real good climber with good safety harness? Thank you, Mel.
Okay, He don't say that they're in Illinois. He says they were designed by WA9HUV. They may not be, you know, the ones that may not be in Illinois. They may be somewhere here, you know. In other words, these were just, the design was done by Norman. You know, yeah, maybe the 2.1 meter dish, maybe that was the one for 1296. Does that sound more feasible? Over.
Yeah. 6 foot diameter, 1296. It's marginal. I again would be more tempted to use a good array of Yagis. 6 foot diameter, 1296. Let's think about that. 9 inch wavelength, 6 foot diameter, 6.5 foot diameter. Let's see, let's do it the right way. I'm going to call it 6.5 feet diameter. I'm going to call it 3/4 of a foot wavelength. So therefore it is 8 1/2 wavelengths. Divide that into 70 degrees. Got a calculated 8-degree beam width. Yeah, quite usable. Quite usable. Lots of guys, though, think they're going to get some kind of real fantastic magic out of a parabolic dish compared to modern-day Yagis. And there may not be quite as much magic there as you think. Most parabolic dishes are kind of heavy and create an awful lot of wind load. So if you're going to mount them on a tower, there's a lot more evolved than first meets the eye. On the ground with a good setup, they work pretty well. But very few guys have put big dishes on towers. The dish that I used on 10 gigs was 2-foot diameter, which gave me a 3.5-degree beam width. And that was a solid dish. The wind load builds up really fast, particularly if you've got an ice storm and high wind afterwards. Maybe the price is right. Back to you, Mel.
Hey, let's say a 2.1 meter dish on 1296. Could you get, what, 25 dB out of it, Dick?
Just happen to have a program that calculates that. Stand by for another 15 seconds. Okay, 2.1 meter diameter, 1296, 26 dB of gain, 8.9 degrees of beam width.
Maybe that's what it was. You think? Try to read between the lines and all. I figured maybe that's what he was using, the 2.1 meter dish, because that sounds like it possibly was working. I would assume that, you know, these antennas, I think, were all designed back, way back, what, 19, what, the 70s sometime, when the drift was then for, I guess, say, for 1296, 2304, using Paraba, you know, parabolic type reflectors. I think that was the trend. I think that was really the subject at that time. Am I correct, over?
Yes. And a lot of developments in good Yagis have occurred since then. So a significant portion of what used to be parabolic dish world has become Yagi world. And when you get beyond 1296 or at 1296 and above, I do recommend loop Yagis over regular Yagis, because when droplets of water are on the elements of a 1296 or 2304 Yagi, it tunes it to another band. That doesn't happen with a loop Yagi. An array of loop Yagis, you can get, without too much effort, 24 dB of gain. That 6.5 foot diameter dish has got 26 dB of gain over isotropic. It's got that capability. But boy, it's going to be 20 times bigger in wind load than that array of Yagis. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, Roger. He says there's one other antenna on the tower. He says it's made by Andrew Corporation. Some kind of dish also. I'm not familiar with this. I don't know what kind of dish he's referring to. Was that a good... He's asking me if it was a good dish in its time. Or, you know, I don't know what it really, you know, what all this means. But a dish made by Andrew Corporation. Does that ring a bell with you, over?
Is the Pope Catholic? Does Andrew ring a bell with me? Andrew is arguably the biggest manufacturer on planet Earth for parabolic dish antennas, air-filled coax cables, and high-power amplifiers. They are the biggest manufacturer in the United States for amplifiers, commercial-grade VHF, UHF amplifiers for two-way communication systems. They are the biggest antenna company and the biggest cable company in the United States. Yes, Mel, I've heard of them.
Oh, in other words, this is the Andrew company that we refer to all the time with Andrew's cable and connectors and all that. Is this the same company? Over.
They are the manufacturer of Andrew Heliax. Their logo has got a lightning symbol in it. The word Andrew is written with red paint. Sound familiar?
And you mean to tell me this company goes back that far? I didn't realize it was the same company, because this company is referring to is back from the 60s, 1965. I didn't realize. I thought they go on the... they don't go on the Andrew Corporation. They go on the Andrews, aren't they? With an S in it, over.
Lots of people made the mistake of calling it Andrew with an S. I don't think it ever had that name. I think the company was invented in the late 50s, Mel. And ever since the middle 60s, we've had Andrew Heliax available to us. Mel, go ahead.
Okay, so in other words, the correct name is not Andrews. It's Andrew with just R-E-W on the end. Is that, in other words, that's the same company you assume, over?
Absolutely. That's the one. And yes, they make a quality product. Whenever you see these drum-shaped antennas, two-way communication antennas, on great big commercial towers, I'll bet you 90-some-odd percent of them are Andrew. And across that drum, you'll see the word Andrew, and you'll see that red lightning symbol. And so lots of people mispronounce it Andrews, but it's Andrew, D-R-E-W. Same company since the late 50s, if not before.
So you say they did make a quality product way back then. All right, well, that's the story then. That's about all we try to... I try to pick through this thing step by step. Again, three pages long here, and what can I say? If you feel you can do something with these antennas, and you want to, like Dick says, you got to know what you're doing. If you got to take them down off for a tower, they can be considerable weight. You got to make sure you do the right rigging. You got to make sure you have the right safety. You got to, I guess, be experienced in some form, or unless you get maybe a crane in to lift them off the tower. I guess that'd be the safest way, because I would assume something like a dish that you're talking about, and if it's the way you say it was made, such quality. I mean, it most likely a 3.7 meter dish. Could wind up with a bit of weight. Am I correct? Over.
Yeah. Andrew has very few antennas with mesh to them. Almost all of them are solid aluminum. A 2.1 meter dish by Andrew, 6 foot diameter. I'm not sure, but if somebody told me it's 150 pounds, I'd believe it.
Okay, so in other words, a 3.7 meter dish made by WNA-A9, designed by WA9HUV, and manufactured, he says they were manufactured by, Mark Antennas, manufacturer of the WA9HUV parabolics. I would assume also it would be a bit of a weight, something in the size of a 3.7 meter dish. I would say that taking these things down sounds like a bit of a project, and if you say they're not in the best of condition, you know, you got to even consider that they don't go near them, and all of a sudden they come loose and come flying down on you, over.
Oh yeah, there's a lot of ways you can get in trouble. If they're only 10 feet off the ground, it's easy. If they're only 10 feet off the ground, people wouldn't be using antennas like that. These things are mounted a minimum of 50 feet up, in my opinion, to really give you any performance that's worth of all the effort of putting up that kind of an antenna. And lowering these kind of antennas from 50 feet or above, there's a significant risk involved. Anything above 30 feet, if you fall, you're a basket fit case. And to exaggerate a little bit, above 50 feet, they pick you up with a sponge.
Nice to hear. Okay, very good. All right, let's see. Let me see. I'll look through. Start looking through here. What's this guy? Oh, another one with a 1296 Yagi. Now the Yagi. Here's a guy asking about a Yagi. What can you tell me about 8 13 element Yagis arranged in a circle? This system was designed and built by, who's this guy? W38ED. Oh my god, I don't know. Gee. Where all of a sudden we get into all these Yagi arrays and all. I don't know. I have to look through this whole thing also, a couple of pages. I don't know where they're coming from, Dick, but they're sure finding us over.
Yeah, I think I'll recognize him. W3AED. He's no longer a ham. Whiskey 3 Alpha Echo Delta, is that correct?
Paul. Because Paul designed a system of lightweight construction consisting of 104 elements for 1296. And he says, describes it, calls it the blowtorch array. Jeez. I'm telling you, they're coming up with names out of, I don't know. I never heard of this thing before. Maybe, I guess this is your department. Go ahead.
I wish I had used those words in the last transmission. I was about to say blowtorch. W3AED is the man in Snug Harbor, Maryland. I think that's where he used to live. Who I've given you the example of. He wrote me 14 consecutive letters in a month and a half period, way back in the 70s. And he was telling me about the blowtorch antenna, the array of Yagis in a circular pattern. Now, there's nothing magic about putting Yagis in a circular pattern versus a diamond pattern versus a tic-tac-toe pattern. There's nothing magic about that. A little bit of difference in the side lobe amplitudes and locations. But I do remember the man in Maryland telling me about his blowtorch antenna. An array of Yagis of any kind that are well-tuned, with the proper spacing, with the proper feeding, will give you the gain that you're supposed to get. You get very close to 3 dB more gain every time you double the number of elements, number of antennas. Measure the gain of any one well-tuned good Yagi by a couple of techniques. You can find out what is the proper horizontal and vertical stacking distance. The long Yagis, they're almost the same. And you stack them at that distance, and stack them in a circle, a square, a diamond, any way you want to. Properly feed them. You'll get all the gain you're supposed to get. And I remember talking to this man in Maryland and writing to him, trying to convince him there's nothing magic about round and blowtorch. But he believed there was. And yes, it can be a good high-performance antenna. You can call it blowtorch, and it's got a lot of good advertising spin to it, if you know what I mean. It'll attract people to the advertisement. And so, on 1296 and above, I strongly recommend all Yagis be either inside of a radome, which is hard, or made out of a loop Yagi technique. And so, in the mid-70s, there was lots of discussions about blowtorch antennas. Brings back memories. Back to you, Mel.
See, I'm reading on here, and he says that the antennas were designed in cooperation with W2CQH. W2CQH. Now that guy is familiar. Oh my God! He wrote a number of articles about Yagis, the 1296 Yagis. Am I correct? Am I thinking the same right person? Take over.
W2CQH is good old Reed Fisher. I'm looking him up right now. I sure hope he's still around. CQH. Morris Plains, sure enough. Oh, he now lives in Georgia. Oh, he retired. Reed Fisher lived in, worked for the Morris Plains Division of Bell Laboratories for lots of years. Had articles about directional couplers, interdigital filters, and the famous 1296 strip line amplifier. A pair of two C39 tubes in parallel as a strip line amplifier on 1296. That's the Reed Fisher. And he was doing that work in the early 70s. And I talked to Reed lots and lots of times on 432 in the mid-70s. Reed Fisher also was doing a lot of research around 1971 on the Bell Laboratory concept that became cell phones. He called it cell phone in 1971. He called it cellular telephone concept, cellular telephone system, where each of the individual transmitters is set on hexagonal squares. He was doing that research in 1971, visiting Japan to find out what's the easiest way to get the hardware manufactured. Darn good, smart guy, Reed Fisher. Dr. Reed Fisher. Back to you, Mel.
Okay, I get to the gist of this now. Okay, the matching transformer that was up there was in an enclosure. The enclosure cover came off and it deteriorated the inside of the matching system in there. Can I go about reduplicating this matching? Where can I get the information on the matching? I guess it was a matching. It must have been a quarter wavelength, I would assume. I mean, what did they use, a quarter wavelength matching system in this type of setup, Dick, over?
Did he say how many Yagis he was feeding, Mel?
I will get it. Let's see how many Yagis he was feeding. Yeah, I saw it here someplace. Yeah. Let's see. Bow torch arrangement, and that's a 13-element Yagis in a circle, and then, let's see, there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, I think it's, let's see, what he has it, oh, he has it numbered originally, he's starting one going around, okay, 8.
Okay, various people have built 2-to-1, 4-to-1, and 8-to-1 power dividers, and there's at least two ways of doing it. An array of 2-to-1 power dividers is one approach. An array of 4-to-1 power dividers is another approach. You can build in one stage an 8-to-1, but it's rare that people do that one. So the power divider usually is done, if it was done by Reed Fisher, it was done with strip line. If it was done by most other people, it would be done as a coaxial quarter wave matching transformer or an array of them. Usually, if they did it the intelligent way, by my standards, the outer diameter is 1-inch square tubing with type N connectors mounted. Like if you're making a 2-to-1 power divider or a 4-to-1 power divider, you have a single type N connector at one end of a quarter wavelength length of square 1-inch aluminum tubing, and two or four type N connectors at the other end, and in between, in down the center, is a piece of brass round tubing. That's the right diameter to make the right characteristic impedance. In the case of a 2-to-1 power divider, the center piece of brass tubing should be a quarter wavelength long and the right diameter to give you 37.5 ohms. So 37.5 ohms gives you 25 ohms at one end and 50 ohms at the other. A pair of 50 ohm devices in parallel makes 25 ohms. So that's one way to do it that's very popular. An array of those, 2-to-1 and 4-to-1 power dividers, built out of square aluminum tubing with brass tubing down the center. Back to you, Mel.
I once saw an application like that for 1296, and they made it. How the heck did they make it? If I remember correctly, they were quarter wavelength transformers. They used little lengths of tubing. It was a little piece of pipe, a little piece of tubing, and they soldered it to a plate, and then they used pieces of cable that they forced through it, and it was like, it was like in a configuration, I'm trying to picture in my mind what I remember seeing, but I remember distinctly that they took pieces of the tubing and a copper sheet, and they soldered it all up, and they made up a whole thing with a core for a matching transformer for outside use, Dick. Am I on the right track, over?
Yeah, one of the famous ones is the semi-rigid tubing, semi-rigid coax cable. 141 is the most popular one, 0.141 outside diameter. And you take a half wavelength of it, bend it into a U-shaped tubing, and bring in another transmission line made out of the same stuff. All three shields get connected together at the same point. The two ends are the U-shaped piece of tubing, semi-rigid coax cable, and the transmission line coming into it. Center conductor of transmission line coming in goes over to the center conductor of one side of the U-shaped tubing, U-shaped coax cable. That is a 4-to-1 matching transformer, called a half-wave coax balance type. And it's fully balanced at what comes out. So fully balanced, in other words, it's a great way to feeding 200-ohm twin leads from a 50-ohm source. So with a slight variation of that, you can easily make 4-to-1 impedance matching devices. But 141 semi-rigid coax cable, you can't go much beyond 100 watts with it at VHF frequencies. And very few people would build that at HF frequencies because it would get a little bit too long. So this blowtorch antenna at 1296, I'll bet you it was made out of arrays of half-wave coax balance with semi-rigid coax cable. Back to you, Mel.
Here also, he says a beautiful part of it is that I'm reading on, you know, a beautiful part of it is they used copper balun tubes, and all elements have to be soldered to the boom. Oh my, I don't know what the heck all this means. I don't know. He went through a whole business here and all about making up, you know, replacement parts for it, where you can get the information. I don't know, really. I really tell you the truth. This goes back, you know, these things go back a lot of years. And I don't know where you're going to really find much information or parts or whatever. He mentions that, you know, maybe Reed, you said Reed Fisher is still around it. If it was designed by Reed Fisher, some of this part of it, or maybe you can, I don't know, Google him and send him an email or something. But it was, I don't understand the situation, how this came about, you know. This guy, Paul, W3AED, I guess, he put the thing together in the blowtorch arrangement, but I guess, is it, from what I understand here, is this Reed Fisher, he's the one, I guess, that, what, designed the individual antennas? Is that what happened, Dick? Over.
That's quite likely. Reed, who now lives in Buford, Georgia, and you can easily QRZ him, and I can tell that he's updated his license in 2001. He was born in 1932. Reed was a pretty healthy guy, spoke with a pretty deep stutter, but a real smart guy. My guess is he's in pretty good shape. He could be talked to. He had when it comes to 1296 transmitters with a pair of 2C39s, he had one of the nicest transmitters going. I think he was experimenting with loop Yagis. I know he was doing a lot of work with strip line filters, strip line hybrids, and impedance matching devices. He and Dr. Dick Turin, W2IMU, of Holmdel Bell Labs. Holmdel Bell Labs had W2IMU, as well as Penzias and Wilson, the two guys who won the Nobel Prize for discovering the Big Bang, and Reed Fisher was working at the Morris Plains division of Bell Labs, and we would all get on 432 and discuss all kinds of subjects like this. They were getting pretty heavy into 1296, 1296 moonbounds. I didn't go to 1296. I decided to concentrate more on 432, and they never gave up 432, so I had a lot of chance to talk to them. So I'm pretty sure that Reed Fisher is talkable. Dr. Dick Chilling is not. He died of a heart attack 8 or so years ago. But Reed is probably an awful nice guy that